Chip, I want to thank you and Harry both very much for your very fine presentation. I want to thank you for all the many hours I know you've already devoted to the making this a successful pledge drive this year. And you have all of Chip's efforts and the people who worked with him. I'd say now it's your turn to get involved as well and offer us as generous a pledge as you can for our upcoming fiscal year. And continue with that theme. This past year, sometime in the past year, our Unitarian Universalist Association published this book through their Skinner House Press called The Abundance of Our Faith. It's a collection of sermons on stewardship and giving. And the way they got the sermons was they went back over the past 20 years to the people who had won a sermon contest the UUA holds every year for someone who can submit a sermon on the whole subject of giving, stewardship, supporting our liberal religious institutions. Some kind of a committee picks the one they think is their best entry for that year, and then the person who wrote it gets to deliver it at the General Assembly. Somehow or other, my first year here, which was the 1988-89 year, I gave a sermon for the pledge drive that year. I sent it into the UUA, and they picked my sermon. So I've got one of the sermons in this book here, got to do with the General Assembly and all the rest of that. And I thought, well, you know, 18 years have gone by since then. I know some of you were here when I did this, but I figured, why not, you know, update this thing, dust it off a little bit, and we can do it again. So if you were here 18 years ago and heard portions of this sermon, you know, my apologies. But the rest of you, this is the first time. I did open it with a reading from a book called The Gift by Lewis Hyde. I think I've used this reading on it for a couple of other times, but this is why I used it for this particular sermon. And what the UUA was doing that year, they were asking you to submit a sermon on the topic of the theology of giving. So that's what this is about. Anyway, this is a reading. I opened up with a reading, as I say, from a book by Lewis Hyde called The Gift. When the Puritans first landed in Massachusetts, they discovered a thing so curious about the Indians' feeling for property that they felt called upon to give it a name. In 1764, when Thomas Hutchison wrote his History of the Colony, the term was already an old saying. An Indian gift, he told his readers, is a proverbial expression signifying a present for which an equivalent return is expected. We still use this, of course, in an even broader sense, calling that friend an Indian giver who is so uncivilized as to ask us to return a gift he's given. Imagine a scene. An Englishman comes into an Indian lodge, and his host, wishing to make the guest feel welcome, asks him to share a pipe of tobacco. Carved from a soft red stone, the pipe itself is a peace offering that is traditionally circulated among the local tribes, staying in each lodge for a time, but given away again sooner or later. And so the Indians, as is only polite, give the pipe to their guest when he leaves. The Englishman is tickled pink. What a nice thing to send back to the British Museum. He takes it home and sets it on his mantelpiece. A time passes and the leaders of a neighboring tribe come to visit the colonist's house. To his surprise, he finds his guests have some expectation in regard to his pipe. And his translator finally explains to him that if he wishes to show his goodwill, he should offer them a smoke and give them a pipe. Give them the pipe. In consternation, the Englishman invents a phrase to describe these people with such a limited sense of private property. Indian giver. But the Indian giver understood a cardinal property of the gift. Whatever we have been given is supposed to be given away, not kept. Or if it is kept, something of similar value should move in its stead, the way a billiard ball may stop when it sends another scurrying across the belt, the momentum of the transfer. The only essential is this: the gift must always move. I can still remember very well the first pledge drive or canvas campaign in which I ever took part. I was all of 13 years old. For when my hometown, Southern West Virginia Baptist Church, conducted an every member canvas, I mean, they meant every member. And since I had been baptized at the age of 10, I was included, not just as a pledger, but as a canvasser as well. So my job in that particular campaign of 1958 was to canvass some of the other young people in the church's junior high youth group that I was in to get each of them to make a pledge for the upcoming year. Now this was literally a nickel and dime effort. Because a dollar a week was really not a bad allowance in those days, especially for that particular part of the country. So 10 cents a week represented a tithe, or 10%. This suggested share was derived from the 28th chapter of the Old Testament book of Genesis, which was taken very seriously in the place where I was raised, in which Jacob promises his God Yahweh a 1/10 return of all the worldly blessings that Yahweh bestows upon him. So, some 3,000 years after this original pledge, there I was riding my bicycle around town, seeing how many dime a week pledges I could secure. I don't remember how successful I was. We must have done okay because the church met and came close to its goal, and it's continued to survive and grow. Now owns a bunch of buildings on the city block where it just had this very modest little building when I was there. What I do remember is being glad that my friends remained my friends, even after I'd lightened their wallets, the 2 to 5 or 10 cents a week. Well, I know that my recounting of such an episode could set off some liberal alarm bells and send a few red flags flying. Oh, isn't that terribly exploitive, sending kids out barely in their teens to shake down the allowances for other kids for a pledge drive campaign using a 10% figure based on some obscure biblical reference? Well, my answer to the Lord is no. Because that campaign gave me and my friends a sense of participation in a larger effort. The church at that time was not even 10 years old. Well, it was 11 years old. It was founded in 1949. And it needed all the help it could get. And it had a very firm sense of its own mission, of who it was, and where it wanted to go, and was able to get that sense of mission shared right down to its very youngest members. And after that canvas drive, it became my church in a way that it really hadn't before. Well, as you know, and as you've heard me relate on other occasions, my own religious and spiritual journey since those days is one that has now brought me to a place where there is very, very little in the way of that church's program or theology that I can relate to. But I still remain forever grateful for the lessons it taught me about institutional ownership and about the value of extending one's personal gifts beyond the bounds of itself, of the self. I still take that lesson from there. So here I am, nearly, gee whiz, 50 years later, a religious liberal for over half my life now, trying to come up with a theology of giving for religious liberals. Interesting term, theology. For it involves more than simply coming to terms with all the usual reasons to financially support a UU congregation. Reasons we need to be made aware of, and we've very much been made aware of earlier in the service. I appreciate that presentation very much. But when we talk about a theology of it, we're looking at these kinds of concerns, and then we're trying to go beyond them as well. For questions of theology deal with the big why, as I call it. It's not just why do we want or need this or that kind of a program or a church staff or well-maintained physical facilities, but why do we care about it? And why do we care for it? Our liberal religious institutions in some kind of an ultimate sense? Does our caring, does our giving operate on that level? Well, in the setting where I was first introduced to the art and adventure of pledging, I can say back there, man, I mean, the theology of giving was very simple and straightforward and right up front. It went like this. All of your worldly possessions, to say nothing of your spiritual salvation, have come ultimately from God. As agents of the Almighty, it is up to us to see that these blessings continue to be bestowed. That is to say, God's work must be our own. And then the bottom line. In order for such work to go forth, God needs 10% of what you made this year, so fill out your pledge card accordingly. And then this will be softened up a little bit with a caveat that we were taught to say in these pledge things. Well, you know, God knows what your financial needs and predicaments are better than any one canvasser. And the Lord is also a God of love and mercy who only expects you to do the best you can. And Jacob probably had some rough years too, where he didn't always make his 10%. Well, I know that godly appeals like that, when it comes to raising money, I know that they can be used for all manner of human exploitation and manipulation. It still saddens and disgusts me even now to think of all the dollars from low and fixed income sources that some televangelists have managed to haul in. But as long as money is going to be raised for religious purposes, there's going to be charlatans out there raking off what they can. That goes for just about any other enterprise as well. But such troublesome realities as these should not prevent us from exploring our own theology of giving as Unitarian Universalists. However difficult many of us, myself included now, may find to both the language that guided my youthful efforts at pledging and canvassing, there was, as I've already been saying, a principle there I think we would really do well to take seriously. For what was really being called for back in that congregation is basically the same thing being called for here. The perpetuation of a gift that has come from a source greater than any one of us, and that continues to be bestowed, needs to continue to be bestowed beyond our lifetimes to all the generations that come after us. Our fundraising efforts back then, which included me pedaling my bike around town, were, in a more ultimate sense, a way of making sure that the gift of our faith and the gift of our church would always move. And this very same principle is also our starting point, I would say, in a search for the Unitarian Universalist theology of giving. The gift is always moving. It's a principle, as Lewis Hyde demonstrates, that has long been present in our Native American culture. And so I'm going to go back to that reading. I want to look at Hyde's illustration a bit more closely in just a moment. But let's consider the nature of the gift itself. In our hymnal, there's a collection of readings to be used for chalice lighting. And there's one there very simply worded by Reverend Marjorie Montgomery that says, "Life is a gift for which we are grateful. We gather in community to celebrate the glories and the mysteries of this great gift." Now, I am aware the expression "life as a gift" can become terribly trivialized, right up there, right down there with, you know, "have a nice day." But seriously consider, it's a very profound affirmation. It's an affirmation for one thing. I think we need to look at this as religious liberals. It's an affirmation of one thing, of human limitation. For however much we religious liberals may celebrate the power of the human spirit, reaches of the human mind, and the strength of the human soul, all good and necessary things that we should do. For all of that, the truth remains that we did not think or will or spiritually generate ourselves into existence. We were given the life we had by a combination of forces that we really had nothing to do with. That life is given to us is a biological and evolutionary reality. Some of the echoes of what Gary said in the chalice light. But to choose to regard it as a gift is an affirmation of faith. It's an affirmation we sometimes need to make in the face of all that might deny us life's gift-like quality. When the philosopher Albert Camus, who an individual I regard as a secular saint, when he pushed life to its extremities, he encountered what he called the absurd, what he considered the ultimate absurdity and meaninglessness of it all. And I would say that no one who lives life at any depth or have had some life-troubling, life-shattering experiences, no one can escape his or her own periodic encounters with kind of the absurd. What is this about? On the other hand, to remain open to all that life offers is to also encounter the gift. Those moments, sure, we've all had them, when we experience, sometimes even in the midst of pain and meaninglessness, the profound givenness of our existence. Let me move to an example. I don't know how many of you have read Annie Dillard's book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. It's a very beautiful, loving, haunting kind of book in places. I want to read just a passage in that. I think she wrote this when she was living in a rural part of Virginia. Last year, I saw three migrating Canada geese flying low over the duck pond where I stood. I heard a heart-stopping blast of speed before I saw them. I felt the flayed hair slap my face. They thundered across the pond and back again. I swear, I have never seen such speed, such single-mindedness, such flailing of wings. They froze the duck pond as they flew. They rang the air. They disappeared. I think of this now. I have glutted on richness. This distant silver November sky, these sere branches of trees shedding and bearing their pure and secret colors. This is the real world, not the world gilded in pearl. I stand under white skies directly, naked without intercessors. I am buoyed by a calm and effortless longing. I have glutted on richness. This is a powerful description of that life as a gift affirmation. Maybe some of you have had those experiences where you just kind of feel something, this profound givenness of all that's around you. You become aware that somehow or other, in ways you maybe cannot fully articulate, but you're a part of all of that. Well, how then do we make our way from this Dillard experience to a Unitarian Universalist theology of giving? I would try this. Persons who choose to affirm that life is a gift and who remain open to the kind of experiences that Ms. Dillard has just described also need ways to assure that the gift will always move. For when the gift stops moving, it ceases to be a gift. This, according to Lewis Hyde, you go back to him now, is what the Native Americans tried to teach the first European settlers on these shores, and for their efforts they were rewarded with the pejorative and racist epithet Indian giver. For the Englishman, the European, the gift was to be kept and taken out of circulation in the hope that it might accrue greater value in the future. But as Hyde points out, the Indian giver understood a cardinal property of the gift. Whatever has been given is supposed to be given away again, not kept. Or if it is kept, something of similar value must move in its stead. And right there, I would say, is the simple kernel for a theology of giving for religious liberals. Life has been given to us by that which is greater than we know. And in order for it to remain a gift, it must remain on the move. There's lots of ways we can move this life gift. We move it personally by sharing it with those whom we love and whom we care about and to those to whom we extend our lives and just who we are. And then moving beyond the personal, we've created institutions. Flawed and fallible institutions, to be sure. But institutions, nonetheless, the purpose of which is to nurture and enhance this life gift. And some of these institutions we call Unitarian Universalist churches or fellowships or societies. And we happen to be one of them. We trip and stumble in our efforts at times. Religious institutions, after all, are only human. But we continue to believe that life is worth the effort and that providing a place where and the means whereby this life gift can be moved along is also worth the effort. As we've already seen, something very precious has been going on here for 180 years. Depending on how you do the math, six or seven generations of religious liberals before us have kept the gift of this liberal religious congregation in Nashville alive and moving. And it's our turn now to make sure that the gift continues to move. But what does all this have to do with money? Great deal, matter of fact. Chip, you probably got a little further than I did in taking economics. I think I had to take like one bonehead economics course because it was required for a degree and I just wanted to get it out of the way. But what I remember from that is that money is a symbolic means of characterizing a certain portion of our life's possessions. It's a symbol, a tangible symbol of what we have and what we earn or what we're fortunate enough in some cases to have been given or inherited. It is a concrete way of representing at least a part of the makeup of our life gift. And as such, our money offers us the means and the opportunity to keep the life gift moving by supporting those institutions that we have created to nurture and sustain it. So no, money can't buy the gift of love, it can't buy the gift of caring, it can't buy the gift of justice, and it can't buy the gift of peace. What it can do, however, what it must do, is provide a setting where if the proper human element, you guys are the proper human element, if the proper human element is present in that setting, then love, caring, and justice and peace can occur. And our Unitarian Universalist churches and societies and fellowships seek to offer such settings where these gifts are bestowed. And our financial support of this church is one of the means by which we make this life gift move. Think about it for a minute. When people come through our doors looking for a place to freely pursue their spiritual journeys and find us to be a place where they can do just that, then the gift moves. When we extend our support to those community organizations seeking to meet a vital human need, as we do every Sunday, the gift moves. And when our children and our young people receive religious education in a loving, nurturing environment that opens up their minds and spirits, the gift moves. When we share some of the deeper regions of our minds and hearts with one another, in covenant groups or some other similar program, the gift moves. When we offer a supportive setting for those seeking to create a more just, sane, and peaceful world, the gift moves. And when we come together to worship here, feel our hearts and minds lifted and strengthened, the gift moves. So if we can affirm that life is a gift, and if we believe that life is sacred, then our moving this gift along is really a sacramental act. I know filling out a pledge card in a generous fashion or placing a contribution in a collection plate may not seem like sacramental acts, but I believe in the truest sense of the word they are. For among other things, a sacrament is a means of expressing gratitude and thanksgiving for all that's been given. And so to offer a financial portion of our life gift in order to keep the gift moving, then, is not something to be downplayed or hushed up, but rather is an act to be joyfully celebrated. So I'm going to close with some expressions of thanksgiving of my own. I thank Annie Dillard for her skillful way of capturing with words life's profound givenness. I thank Lewis Hyde for providing a marvelous account what it means to be a giver of gifts. As one who originally also came to this country from England, I offer a rather belated thanks on behalf of my British ancestors to those Native Americans who tried to teach them that the gift must always move. And my final words of thanksgiving are twofold. Not here so we can do it in person. Some of them are in the ground behind us here. But I want to thank the people who founded this congregation 180 years ago, this past September, for their vision and for their determination to put that vision on the ground. I mean, quite literally, put it on the ground right here where we are, both for themselves and for the generations who have come after. And finally, I thank each of you, you who have pledged already and you who will be doing so, for honoring vision that our founders had, for keeping that vision real today, and for moving it forward for all of those who will follow after us. Our closing hymn is Forward Through the Ages. It is number 114. Let's sing that together. And as you leave, pick up your pledge envelopes or get the pledge packets. When you leave here, pick them up in the dining room during the coffee hour. Okay.